Genesis 18, verses 23 through 32. So once you find it, if you will stand in honor of the Holy Scriptures, I will read it to you. And Abraham drew near and said, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from thee. Should not the judge of all the earth do right?" And the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes." And Abraham answered and said, "Behold, now I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes. Peradventure there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city for lack of 5? And he said, "If I find there 45, I will not destroy it." And he spake again unto him yet again, and said, "Peradventure there shall be 40 found there." And he said, "I will not do it for 40's sake." And he said to him, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Peradventure there shall be 30 found there." And he said, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." And he said, "Behold, now I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure there shall be 20 found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for 20's sake." And he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for 10's sake." You may be seated. You know there wasn't 10 found in all of Sodom, and the place was destroyed. But he did have a way where he let 4 righteous people leave, and one of them disobeyed him and turned into salt.
Well, good morning. As you glean from today's scripture reading in Genesis 18, 23 through 32, in criminal law, William Blackstone formulated the principle that it is better that 10 guilty persons escape than one innocent suffer. Now, the actual numbers or ratio is not as important as the idea that the state should not cause undue or mistaken harm, just in case. And historically, the details of the ratio change, but the message that the government and the courts must err on the side of innocence is constant, or should be. The concept is much older than the commentaries on the laws of England from Blackstone, which is why I chose today's scripture in Genesis 18 about the destruction of Sodom, which, it must be noted, God did eventually destroy, but with the innocent getting out of Dodge before it happened. Similarly, we are told in Revelation 18:4, "To come out of her, my people, that ye receive not of her plagues." Now, Blackstone's maxim was also absorbed into American common law, cited repeatedly by our founding fathers, later becoming a standard drilled into law students all the way into the 21st century. I would really be shocked and dismayed if Curtis's prosecutors never heard of this fundamental precept of law. Perhaps it's as diminished as 1 hour of instruction in nutrition in medical schools. Or maybe the spiritual analogy that religion is only for people to feel good in today's contemporary seminaries. Defending British soldiers charged with murder for their role in the Boston Massacre, John Adams also expanded upon the rationale behind Blackstone's formulation when he stated, "It is more important that innocence should be protected than it is that guilt be punished, for guilt and crimes are so frequent in this world that all of them cannot be punished. When innocence itself is brought to the bar and condemned, especially to die, the subject will exclaim, 'It's immaterial to me whether I behave well or ill, for virtue itself is no security.'" And if such a sentiment as this were to take hold in the mind of the subject, that would be the end of all security whatsoever. End quote. Indeed, it would open the floodgates of a dictatorship where the government itself is above the law and selectively prosecutes whomsoever they want eliminated from their society. A Curtis is not the first innocent man to be found guilty in an American courtroom for murder. And the way things are going, he will not be the last. But if we say nothing about this case, we may see our name on the docket. It should be understood by all freedom-loving Americans that totalitarian regimes are adamantly opposed to the principle of saving one innocent man from the guilt of many. It's the mindset of kill them all and let God sort it out. Although I doubt God is an integral factor with that crowd. If God were a consideration, then justice would be considered as well. Now, Abraham knew the judge of all the earth would do right. He does not plead that the wicked may be spared for their own sakes, or because it would be too drastic to destroy them, but for the sake of the righteous who might be found among them. And righteousness can only be made in the form of a plea before God, not plea bargains before human prosecutors. Our commitment to free Curtis Monsky is firstly a pleading before the divine court, which will in turn plead to the heart of the governor of Washington State. Abraham petitioned heaven for intercession to spare Lot and his family. Oh, wait a minute. What did Jesus say about his return to earth? What was the sign? "And the world would be as in the days of Lot." Being born and raised in Washington, I know a little about the current governor, Jay Inslee, who went to law school, is a Democrat, and was a U.S. congressman. Earlier this year, Governor Inslee suspended the death penalty in Washington by issuing stays of execution to its 9 death row prisoners. In a statement, the governor's office explained Inslee's reasoning. Quote, Inslee said it is clear to him that the use of capital punishment is inconsistent and unequal, and it's time to have a conversation about ensuring equal justice under the law. Equal justice under the law is the state's primary responsibility. And in death penalty cases, I'm not convinced equal justice is being served, end quote. Okay, it's a start that may open the door and his heart to the reality of a wrongful conviction and travesty of justice. You know, we've all heard of Johnny Appleseed. But did you know we also have planters in Christian Identity? In one of Curtis's recent letters, he wrote an elated prayer report about our FGCP, our corporate prayers for him. He said, "We ask for strength, patience, endurance, courage, and peace. And our Father has provided it. It's amazing," he said. "Our God has provided a comfort I have never known, and an insight with maturity that shocked me. My faith and loyalty to our profession has never wavered. I fight this system. I stand. I encourage others. Sometimes we get selfish, stuck in our own problems, personalizing everything, and this blinds and binds us. I would often think, this isn't fair, and it wasn't. But what are we to expect? These are God's enemies, the beast system. And so, am I expected to go to the beast and say, please, will you be fair? Will you do the right thing? Of course not. I was talking to my attorney, and she says, I just don't see how they can't see our position. And it clicked. Duh! They did see our position. Very clearly. And they act as only our adversary can, unjustly. Matthew 21:22 says, "And all things, whatsoever you ask in prayer, believing, ye shall receive." And in Romans 8:28 says, "We know all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purposes." What God revealed to me is that if we pray believing, it will correspond to God's will, not ours. If I pray to be released, that is selfish, and I may or may not be in His will. If I ask for my will to be done, it is not in belief. In our corporate prayers, we ask that God's will be done, come what may. Now, that is such a dynamic three words. I think I just might do a sermon on it someday, because that's kind of an underlying theme of his attitude and what's happened to him. Come what may. To have strength to fight the adversary, courage to face adversity, endurance to withstand the fiery darts of our enemies, and to be at peace in the artificial environment of a prison. Ephesians 6:12, "For we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and authorities, against the powers of darkness, against spiritual wickedness in high places." The U.S. Supreme Court is the highest court in the land, is it not? So we are asking them to be fair? This will only be possible if God has purposed it. I cannot ask God to insert my desires into His grand design, for that would be asking in unbelief. And I might add here that the highest court in the land did turn down Curtis's petition. He continues, "Perhaps God's will is for me to be in here, riding the federal circuit, for they pay big bucks to fly me all over the country, lighting a fire at each stop. Luke 12:49 says, Jesus came to send fire on the earth that my purpose is already ignited. I interpret this to mean that he does not want us to be idle, waiting for him to do it all for us. He wants us in the faith to put it to work ourselves, to get the fires going. I remember Samuel Adams saying, it does not require a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen to set brush fires in people's minds. Well, back to the point of the prayer report, since y'all began praying, he's talking like us now, y'all, I have been at peace. I have been thankful and exceedingly blessed. Even as I lay to sleep, I feel comfortable and smile and say, thank you, Father. Now, this is amazing because these prisons keep making the beds smaller and smaller. Mine is about 2 feet wide, little more than a bench. And I might add here that Curtis suffers from a knee and shoulder injury, which he's had surgery on. He says, I used to begrudgingly eat every bite of food. Now, it seems more pleasant while I pray. While my adversaries wish to deprive me of nutrients and feed me secret GMOs and aspartame, God protects me and allows my body to be nourished. I smile at a bite that doesn't taste so bad, and I say, thank you, Father. These are small things, but are miraculous to me. I know that we have brethren who have pains and trouble sleeping. They're struggling and going through hell. And all I mean to say is that it is the prayers that have allowed me to endure this hell, end quote. Well, that really is quite a testimony from Curtis. Come what may, is putting yourself on God's side no matter what happens. We couldn't have a better ambassador of Christ inside the prison system today than Curtis Monksk. But we don't believe in incarceration. It's not a biblical remedy for justice. Furthermore, justice proceeds out of God's character of love, so that the purpose of justice is correction rather than destruction. It should never be confused with the divine retribution for capital sins. Therefore, Curtis has fought the good fight, has planted the seeds of hope, and proves his love for God by his walk with Christ for the last 10 years, and now deserves clemency, which is the ethics of mercy, the cousin of judgment. Perhaps the prosecutors of Curtis in his case are not familiar with what Jesus meant in Matthew 7:2 when he said, for with the judgment by which you condemn, you shall be judged, and with the measure by which you measure, it shall be measured with you. And that includes how a governor evaluates and decides a clemency case. In ancient times, the judges, they did not have the right to judge any man by his own standards. He was called to administer the law of God. And so his judgment was not supposed to be his own. And it's the same with us today. All of Curtis's remedies of law, of man-made law, have failed. It is only through the law of God that Curtis has been exonerated. And Curtis is at peace with God's law. But we wrestle against the secular laws that resemble ancient Babylon. That's why we are putting into motion this project to free Curtis from an injustice that never should have happened. Curtis did not kill anybody. That much is clear from the court transcripts and testimony. He was, however, in proximity to the crime scene. One of the perpetrators testified that he was a mile away. And Curtis was acquainted with the actual perpetrators of the murder. Was in the classic wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people that would be used to sentence him to life imprisonment. But even that is not why they really went after him. The truth is they hated what he represented in his religious and political beliefs. That's why he's in prison. It's not that much different than the persecution of Christians in the first century, in so much that Curtis has not been literally thrown into a den of lions or crucified. Modern persecution is psychological torment to break one's spiritual bond with Christ. Curtis is excited that this project can be used of the brethren as a tool to bring forth a myriad of reasons for the cause of righteousness. It's just the right thing to do. Not as a matter of anything selfish on the part of Curtis, but as the creed of the American Revolution declared, resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. The selfish thing to do is not to resist at all, to be the innocuous bystander, watching your neighbor being hauled off to distant gulags. This can only lead to one thing. Someday, they'll knock on your door and drag you off to points unknown. It helps to have friends. Or you don't even have to be a friend of Curtis or me, but you do have to be principled friendly. What is the principle of what shall make us free? It's the truth. We have to love the truth as well as our brethren. Curtis is currently working on two petitions, one of which is an online petition of clemency, and the other is a petition drafted for the free world of stout-hearted, conscientious Americans to sign, so that when presented to the Washington State governor, it will persuade him to grant clemency, that is, mercy. We also need to raise $1,500 to pay an experienced professional organization to spearhead the effort. According to the National Clemency Project, no inmate submitting his or her own application has ever been successful. So $1,500 is a very fair and reasonable fee for the work that is required for such a complete and thorough presentation. And this organization has been somewhat successful. The website, freecurtis.com, that's Curtis with a K, is slowly but surely coming together with all the information one needs to know about the case. We hope to have a PayPal function soon with an automatic shutoff when the goal is reached. The truth is that Curtis had no prior knowledge of what was to transpire the night Mr. Townsend died, nor was he at the crime scene, as trial and appeal transcripts prove, when the attack happened. When he learned of the attack, he quickly and decisively parted company with those who attacked Mr. Townsend. One of the reasons Curtis was convicted was because he was labeled a white supremacist, and two ADL talking heads were at trial to convince the jury that Volksfront, of which Curtis was associated, was a violence-prone organization, or more succinctly, a gang-related hate group. In his personal restraint petition, Curtis needed the help of Volksfront leader Randall Krager to counter the ADL claims in a simple affidavit denying their charges. Curtis's defense made sure that Volksfront was alleviated from any criminal or violent ties to this case, specifically that Volksfront was a white civil rights organization professing nonviolence and opposing hate crimes. But Krager never responded to help a fellow comrade. In fact, even if there was a liability on Krager's part, the statute of limitations had run out. Curtis was tried separately and testified that he was not a member of Volksfront. He categorically stated that he was not a member and only donated $50 as a supporter, which entitled him to a supporter's T-shirt and a baseball cap. The media was complicit in disinformation by implying Curtis was the Washington State coordinator for Volksfront. Of course, the media is not concerned about the truth, and oftentimes this will affect the local jury pool. Lord knows, outspoken white people are demonized for daring to speak out or taking a stand for their own race in various media. All three co-defendants agreed that Curtis was not present when the assault took place, and that he was not involved in the decision to assault Mr. Townsend. Two of these defendants, David Palatos and Scotty Butters, had already inflicted the injuries which led to Mr. Townsend's death before Curtis came to the crime scene. After the assault, Palatos and Butters found Curtis a good distance away. The two eyewitnesses to the assault, Cindy Pittman and Terry Hawkins, who had nothing to gain or lose, testified that they saw the assault and that Curtis was not party to it. Terry Hawkins reiterated that he saw two men and one woman kicking and hitting Mr. Townsend, and later a fourth behind the three who did not participate at all. That was Curtis. The co-defendants, Palatos, Butters, and Fry, who testified pursuant to favorable plea bargains and the testimony of disinterested bystanders, were largely supportive of Curtis's explanation that his only involvement was the prodding of Mr. Townsend sometime after the assault and did not otherwise participate in the assault. The physical evidence supports this as well. Clothes taken from Curtis's three co-defendants tested positive for Mr. Townsend's blood, whereas Curtis's tested negative. All of this is substantiated from the court transcript of the trial and expert testimony in forensics. If the evidence is looked at with objectivity, it's clear that Curtis had no role in the death of Mr. Townsend at all. The evidence supports that the most Curtis did was prod Mr. Townsend with a bat in an effort to check his condition. Indeed, it is very unlikely that he could have hit Mr. Townsend with the bat and have gotten no blood on his boots or clothes, given Mr. Townsend's condition after the assault of Butters, Palatos, and Fry. This evidence includes the testimony of Curtis and of every eyewitness and participant, and of the physical evidence. Only one person said that Curtis used any kind of force with the bat, and that's the female, Tristan Fry, the star witness who received an 11 to 13 year sentence in exchange for her testimony versus Curtis, who received a life sentence without parole. Now, Miss Fry was pregnant with Pilato's baby at the time of the crime. And before the trial, letters from jail between the two were intercepted and show conspiracy to commit perjury. The prosecutor's office was well aware of the intercept and how that would play out at trial, and chose to ignore that and pursue a plea bargain so that they could throw the book at Curtis. Mrs. Fry was allowed by the government to testify that she was not a white supremacist or a skinhead, in spite of the fact that at pretrial, they admitted she was, claiming she was deeply involved, possessing a copy of her membership application to Aryan Nations, having evidence of her yelling racial slurs in Tacoma before this crime, photos of her in skinhead attire, and naming her baby after Robert Matthews and David Lane. The government had possession of a private letter that Fry had written to Curtis before she got her sweet deal, wherein she acknowledged that he was innocent, as opposed to the others who were truly responsible. Curtis's attorney at trial opposed bringing Dr. Mark Pitcavage forward as an expert witness. To paraphrase his statement, Curtis's attorney, Dr. Pitcavage, and I'm not sure if he was with the ADL, but he was certainly adversarial, hostile witness to Curtis. This is what he said, and this is critical in understanding how this applies to all of us. He said in the state's statement of clarification regarding the qualifying organization or identifiable group, the state wanted to have Dr. Pitcavage take the stand and testify that white supremacy, which they assert is an idea or a concept, and that white supremacy can also be taken as a whole and can be seen as one group, that it's an identifiable group, that it has a hierarchy, and the defendant can do something to obtain membership in the group of white supremacists, or do something to maintain membership in the group of white supremacy, or he can somehow rise in an organization called white supremacy, end quote. Well, I've been a white supremacist all these years, and I didn't know the aforementioned. Does the prosecution have an address of the headquarters and whoever's in charge of this hierarchy? I'd like to know. Please, such an exaggerated hyperbole does not belong in an American court of law. The courts have their own language called legalese, but this is calumnies, like slander. It's the language of defamation, which the ADL speaks fluently. Curtis sent me a number of bullet points he wanted posted, and they're on the website now. But the last one he posed was this question: why me? And thus the following comments from him. Quote, people need to understand that there is more to this case than meets the eye. I'm not referring to my actual innocence, but that this case created precedents for the government. It can be used against anyone the government doesn't like. They did not put me in prison because I allegedly committed a crime. They put me in prison because of what I believe. Washington State had a significant skinhead scene and racialists that were extremely active, as opposed to other areas of the country. They used my case to disrupt racial activism and almost overnight destroyed all the progress that had been made. This now can happen to any one of us, anywhere, anytime, end quote. Now, Curtis further explained this precedence in a letter to me, which I posted under the title Addendum to the Introduction on the homepage, in which he explained, I was thinking over the letter I had sent, listing important points, and that's the introduction, and I realized I left out a major point. When I explained why this is important, why people should care, is because if you look at my petition for certiorari rari to the U.S. Supreme Court, starting on page 24, you'll read the government-approved jury instructions. Specifically, the jurors were told that they could find me guilty of first-degree murder as an accomplice. The jurors were told that it was not required that I personally premeditated or participated in the murder to find me guilty. To be found guilty under Washington state law of first-degree murder, you have to meet a two-pronged test. One, actus reus, that is, the act of a crime, and two, mens rea, that is, the mentality of the crime or premeditation. You have to personally meet both criteria. The state was allowed to tell the jury that I was guilty even if I did not personally premeditate or participate in the murder, as long as one of my co-defendants did. That's Tristan Fry. They told the jury that I was guilty even if I prodded the victim lightly with a bat to check his condition, because this was considered encouragement, making me guilty as an accomplice. This to convict instruction is so dangerous because it implies that someone could be guilty of first-degree premeditated murder as an accomplice without acting with intent to cause a death. People may read this and say, well, I don't associate myself with criminals. I have nothing to fear. It says, turn to page 18 of the same petition. I was convicted of this crime because of my beliefs and associations violating the First Amendment. The government said I was in a group and identified this group as white supremacy. The Court of Appeals said this could apply to any number of people with a commonality, such as a law firm, a political party, or even the Catholic Church. The precedence is set with my case to essentially put anyone in prison who falls out of favor with the government. For example, if you're an environmentalist running a website encouraging people to carpool, you could be identified as a carpooler. Because you run a website, you are now a ringleader. A carpooler kills a non-carpooler in a road rage incident. The government can make you guilty as an accomplice. The government actually told the jury evidence regarding white supremacist literature and materials seized at the defendant's residence is being admitted for the purpose of proving motive, premeditation, and you must not consider the evidence for any other purpose, end quote. It's not an exaggeration to say this really could happen to anyone. No one is safe with legal precedents such as this. And how many people even know about it? Not a cheerleader squad? Not for a sports team? Certainly not for any white nationalist or Christian identity adherents. I just wanted to make sure I explained that and that it's understood that if my case goes unchallenged, there will, no doubt, be more. In the introduction, Curtis stated, I refused to cooperate with authorities and was unwilling to say what they wanted me to say. Because I exercised my rights, guaranteed by law, this angered those who are paid to enforce the law. They wanted to use me as a tool to destroy a legal political movement they despised. My three so-called friends, the actual perpetrators of the crime, on the other hand, were ready to cooperate in exchange for lenient sentences. Indeed, one of my co-defendants, who was literally caught red-handed, has already been released from any further incarceration. I was prosecuted along with the others, but refused to cooperate. I was charged with capital murder, narrowly avoiding the death penalty, although it was uncontested that I didn't know about the assault, was not present at the scene of the crime, and could not have prevented it. If you visit our website, you will see declarations from the former lead prosecutor, Barbara Corey, who spoke out against this travesty of justice that Curtis suffered and actually sued the prosecutor's office. She won the lawsuit and was awarded more than $3 million. However, Curtis never saw any judicial relief as a result of that lawsuit, even though it proved his innocence. In Corey's declaration, she stated, Pilatos and Fry's efforts to manipulate the plea and trial processes were known to the prosecutors, Gerald Holm, Jerry Costello, Greg Greer, and other deputy prosecutors and police detectives. Now, for her heroic whistleblowing, she was fired and set the groundwork for the lawsuit. Yeah, none dare call it corruption. But prosecutorial misconduct cost the taxpayers $3 million. And the man they railroaded still sits in prison. The prosecutors, defendants in the Corey lawsuit didn't lose any money. And they're not in jail for the false imprisonment of Curtis Musk. They are most likely enjoying the good life in Babylon, out on a golf course, or perhaps boating in Puget Sound or some other recreation to divert their minds from what they did. There's a preponderance of evidence that goes into detail that's going on the website that should convince anyone that Curtis should be vindicated. The incredible progression of events is astounding. And I jokingly told Curtis that his life story could be a movie, but Hollywood would never touch it without demonizing and twisting the characters and beliefs to color public perception, like the movie American History X, which was about a skinhead. We have a dubious document that gives us an inside look at the crime from the perspective of the prosecution, dealing with the amendment to Tristan Fry's plea bargain, to wit, quote, after almost a year of continuing investigations and the compilation of almost 6,000 pages of discovery, the state now has a clear understanding of the details of the murder, including acts of each defendant. This investigation also now includes a recent and lengthy tape-recorded statement given by Fry concerning the details of the murder. The reason Fry is being offered this reduction is because, one, her reluctance to participate in the crime, two, the substantially lower level of her culpability in committing the crime as compared to her co-defendants, three, the difference in the amount of physical harm she inflicted on Mr. Townsend as compared to her co-defendants, four, her remorse and horror expressed from shortly after the murder was committed to the present time, and five, her willingness to take responsibility for her actions and to cooperate in the prosecution of her co-defendants. Let me stop there and point out that all five elements are contradicted by other sworn testimony as far as Curtis is concerned. In brief detail, Fry has told the state that she was the first of four charged defendants to encounter Mr. Townsend. The victim came upon Fry as she was drinking beer in the general vicinity of the subsequent murder. Fry had become separated from the other co-defendants. The victim approached Fry as she was drinking a beer and began speaking with her. He asked for a swig of her beer, and she gave him the remainder. The two then began smoking cigarettes. Shortly after this, the victim walked away toward some railroad tracks where he encountered defendants Butters and Pilatos. Butters spoke briefly with the victim, who soon became afraid and tried to run away. The victim had run a very short distance when he looked back to see if he was being followed. As he did so, Butters, having pursued him, struck him in the side of the head with a baseball bat. The blow was so hard that the bat broke, and the victim was rendered apparently unconscious. Fry's response to witnessing this act was to freeze, as if in shock. As the victim lay unconscious on his back, Butters and Pilatos stood on each side of him and violently kicked his head back and forth between them with a force Fry has described as hard as they could. Butters and Pilatos were wearing steel-toed boots. This went on for about a minute before Pilatos noticed a small boulder-sized rock. Pilatos picked up the heavy rock, raised it above his head, then threw it forcefully straight down into Mr. Townsend's face, hitting him in the mouth and nose region. After this act, Butters grabbed the victim under the arms, Pilatos grabbed him by the legs, and they carried him to the nearby railroad tracks. Based on Fry's statement, together with independent evidence, it is believed that Butters and Pilatos positioned the victim's body by placing him face down across the railings on the track. The victim's face was positioned on one of the rails with his mouth wide open as if he was biting the rail. It is firmly believed that Butters and Pilatos next performed what is known as a curb stomp on the victim, which is straight out of the movie American History X. Is this life imitating art? They stomped on the back of the victim's head several times with the heels of their boot to ensure his death. After this act, Butters and Pilatos and Fry walked further up the tracks in order to find defendant Monsky. As they walked, Butters kept repeating that he had killed that guy. Pilatos ran ahead and located Monsky, and the four defendants then returned quickly to where the victim had been left, with Butters and Monsky running slightly ahead. Pilatos and Fry soon arrived at the scene where they found the victim now on his back, gurgling blood and apparently still alive. Monsky then brutally beat the victim over and over in the face with a baseball bat. Now, let me stop right there. Didn't the baseball bat break? Yeah, it did. According to Fry, finished him off. Either Butters or Monsky or both had turned the victim over onto his back before Monsky began this final attack. Now, keep in mind, this is the prosecutor's amendment to the plea bargain. It was at this time that Pilatos informed Fry that she must also kick the victim. Fry stated she couldn't do it. However, Pilatos grabbed her from behind the neck, forced her to walk up to the victim. Then he covered her eyes with his hand and told her to kick, and she did. Fry kicked the victim in the head three or four times with such force that her knee hurt the next day. The four defendants then left. End quote. Apparently, the prosecution could care less about the two eyewitnesses and Tristan Fry herself, saying that in sworn testimony that Curtis never assaulted Mr. Townsend. Here's what they said. This is out of the actual transcript in questioning eyewitness Cindy Pittman at trial. It was asked, question, it wasn't until they came face to face with you that you were able to recognize that the fourth individual was not participating, correct? Answer, yes. Question, and then you told these attorneys when they showed you a photograph that this fourth individual was not participating was Mr. Monsky. Answer, yes. He was the last one I seen come out from under the bridge. Question, okay, are you concerned that anybody from the state, prosecutors, or law enforcement is trying to pressure you to say something that's not true? Answer, yes, I am, in a way. Question, what do you mean by that? Answer, because I seen three people around the body. Question, replies affirmatively. Answer, the fourth person, I couldn't tell you. I mean, there was a fourth person there, but I couldn't tell you what their involvement was. I don't want something to happen to somebody that didn't do nothing. At the same time, I don't think that the people that I know that they did, I think they were getting off lightly. Question, is there anything we can do to make it so you think the process is fair? Answer, no. I guess you just have to do your job. In questioning Tristan Fry as to her participation in the assault, question, Curtis didn't make you do that, did he? Answer, no, he didn't. Question, in fact, he had nothing to do with that at all, did he? Answer, correct. She was then asked about a letter she wrote to Curtis a few months after being booked. Question, do you recall writing that right there? Answer, yes. Question, and what did you say? Answer, I said someone's got to be punished for this crime. It might not be you. It might be the one who truly did this. Question, someone's got to be punished for this crime? Answer, yes. Question, but remember, it might not be you. It might be the one who is true, who truly did this. At that point, there was an objection which was sustained. Question, maybe the one that truly did it would get punished instead of Curtis. Correct? Answer, correct. Finally, in questioning Scotty Butters, he was asked, question, so you acted as an accomplice to murder in the first degree. Now, as an accomplice, is it fair to say what you meant was you knowingly assisted in the commission of a murder in the first degree, correct? Answer, I guess. Question, and your testimony that you've given earlier was that Curtis did not knowingly assist in the crime of murder in the first degree, did he? True. Answer, true. These are just a few of the highlights that should be overwhelmingly compelling testimony as to the innocence of Curtis Monsky. Now, I've used the word innocent purposefully and quite a bit throughout this message, instead of not guilty, because of the circus of what American jurisprudence has become. The English common law and biblical concept of innocent until proven guilty has been replaced with guilty until proven not guilty. Prosecutors want prosecutions, and so they stain the character of the accused from the get-go. And to add insult to injury, they'll put you in an orange jumpsuit and parade you around in handcuffs and shackle your feet. Now, I don't know if Curtis was in one of these costumes, but he was in restraints, giving the jurors the impression that he was prone to violence, even though there was no past history of any such behavior. He was a skinhead, a white nationalist, and God forbid one of those identity Christians whom during Y2K the FBI predicted in their Project Megiddo all hell would break loose from these types of radicals. Of course, no such thing ever happened, but they got the best bang for their bucks in the propaganda. Most lawyers, not worth their salt, will tell you that there's no such thing as innocence. The distinction could be made that not guilty means that there was not enough evidence to move a juror beyond the reasonable doubt, whereas innocent means that one has not committed a crime. Juries in courts of admiralty, signified by a red, white, blue, and yellow flag, do not find persons innocent. Admittedly, there are some criminals that have pretty sleazy lawyers who know every loophole in warehouses of law books to find their client not guilty when they're dirty. O.J. Simpson is probably one of the best-known examples of a not guilty verdict. Jesus Christ is the most well-known case of an innocent man found guilty. And Lord knows how many hundreds of thousands of innocent Christians have followed in his steps only to be prosecuted by a self-serving system of beast empires, which have landed on our shores and persecute the woman of Revelation chapter 12. Pontius Pilate said, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person," meaning Christ. But in the very next verse, we read about the people who actually killed Christ. And they said, "His blood be on us and our children." This is a people's who embrace and flaunt their guilt in perpetuity and circumvent the laws of God, denying He who is our judge, our lawgiver, and our king, the three branches of government, which they so expertly subvert by way of deception. Justice has become just us, meaning those who conform to the world. If you are a nonconformist, like Curtis, you too could be spending the rest of your life behind bars. Why does the enemy of mankind make so many laws? It's because they are the author of confusion. I pray that the Curtis Monk's story has not been a confusing one, but rather a clear case in which we can all stand with him as if we were in his boots. As a saying goes, if we don't stand for something, we'll fall for anything. And I pray that you visit the website, freecurtis.com, get informed, sign the petitions, write letters to Governor Inslee, donate what you can for the National Clemency Project, tell others, and above all else, be in fervent prayers for all concerned, and may God have mercy on us all. Thank you.